This is the Music Buzz Podcast. Music Buzz Podcast features candid discussions with and about those behind the scenes in the music business, including industry veterans representing the segments of musician, design, and live. All three Music Buzz Podcast hosts have spent their careers working with the biggest names in entertainment and have been and are still a fly on the wall. Dane Clark as the drummer for John Mellencamp's band for over 20 years and various solo projects. Hugh Syme, a world-renowned graphic artist for the biggest names in music and the corporate world. Andy Wilson, an award-winning marketing and public relations executive with over 20 years of combined multi-level entertainment industry experience in the music and sports business. Now let's buzz.
Hello and welcome back to the Music Buzz Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Andy Wilson, along with Dane Clark. Hey, Dane.
Hi, Andy.
And also Hugh Syme. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Andrew.
Today's guest is Vicki Hamilton. She has Indiana roots. We're going to talk about that a little bit. She's a Grammy Award-winning music industry executive, personal manager, and writer.
And former Hoosier.
Yeah, we'll dig into that for sure. She's one of the most successful female music executives in rock history. She helped develop the careers of Motley Crue, Stryper, Poison, Faster Pussycat, Guns N' Roses, and more. She also worked in A&R at Geffen, Capitol, and Vapor Records before starting her own record label, where she worked with June Carter Cash, among others. And so collectively, the bands that she has worked with for the years have sold 250 million albums. So that's pretty impressive. That's a lot. That's a lot of albums. That's more albums than I can think about. But anyway, welcome to the Music Buzz, Vicki. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. So you mentioned you're a Hoosier, and obviously we're all based in Indiana. So I'm in Indy, Dane is in Anderson, and Hugh is in Newcastle. So tell us, go back to the beginning. Tell us about the Indiana roots.
I was born in West Virginia, but in sixth grade, I moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana. My dad was an electrical engineer at B.F. Goodrich, the other tire company. So that's how I ended up in Fort Wayne. Managed my first bands in Indiana, a band called Dynasty and a band called Destin. And there was a band from Ohio called Ebenezer that I was like working with. So it was kind of my intention to bring them out to Los Angeles and get them record deals, no matter that I didn't really know anybody who signed record deals. I thought, oh, it's easy. I'll just go figure it out.
And you did.
Yeah, it sounds like you did.
Yeah, I did. Took me a few years. Also, I met Tom Petty when I was in Indiana. I was writing for the Three Rivers Review, which was a free press in Fort Wayne. Couldn't get anybody in California to like give me the go-ahead to like interview him. So I chased him down in Indiana. Me and my friend went to South Bend to see him play. The tour bus, we decided we would just since it was a small enough town, we could search out the tour bus. So we went into this gas station and said, where's the nicest hotel in town? He told us, and, you know, the first one, no. Second one, yeah, there it was. So we were sitting there laying in wait, like trying to like stalk his tour bus, thinking he'll come get on the bus. But little did we know they were on the bus. So when they got off the bus, my friend said to me, it's now or never. She was the photographer, right? Mm-hmm. I jumped out of the car, grabbed him by the arm and said, hey, can I like interview you? And he's sure. Come on up to my room, Miss Vicki. It kind of started there. But, you know, Tom told me that I looked like a California girl. And after that, it was on. I'm moving.
That's all you need.
All it took. That's it.
Yeah.
What year was that?
I think that was 80. I moved in 81. I came for a month and I stayed with a woman who was a nurse in Marina Del Rey, kind of like the only person I knew that lived in California. I went back for a year, saved money and moved, basically. Okay. And John Scott, who was a radio guy that broke Tom Petty's career, kind of took me under his wing and like introduced me to a few people. And it really started there.
It's a seductive town. I always say you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. Once you're there, you know, if you've made the right connections, it's a fabulous, especially in the era you were there and that I was there.
Yeah.
That was a special two decades.
The 80s were great.
Weren't they?
Now it's like Hollywood's a little scary. I was like in Hollywood last night to see Ricky Rackman's tour that he's doing called One Foot in the Gutter. And, you know, it was just like scary. I'm like walking around Hollywood Boulevard with my friend Janice, and it's just like crackheads everywhere. You know, it's like you don't know, get robbed or what. And I lived in Hollywood up until about 4 months ago. I live in Glendale. It's very quiet here and happy to be here.
So 1981, you move out there. So when and how do you get started? I mean, I know you mentioned you lived out there for a little bit with the nurse.
I cocktail waitressed at a few places, Gazzari's. Well, the first one was at the Palomino, Gazzari's, and I ended my cocktailing career at the Starwood. Then I started as a record buyer at Licorice Pizza on the Sunset Strip, and that's really kind of where it started for me. Mm-hmm. I was like catty corner from the Whiskey a Go-Go, so I saw everything coming and going and kind of in awe of the whole town. We did a lot of in-stores. You know, we did the Go-Go's and Oingo Boingo, but it was amazing.
So what was it about working there that was just kind of seeing the action where, you know, because it's one thing to work in a record store and to be in Hollywood and all that stuff, but it's another thing to have the wherewithal to be like, I think I can help these people. I want to help these people. And then to get it done, you know, when did the flip the switch type thing? And you realize, I think I can help these bands out and then actually do it.
Well, the ones that I took out from Indiana, like Tony Binch, the baseball player, was the uncle of the Destin band. And he lent us the money to like get a house in the valley. And they like came out, and two of the kids went back right away. They got homesick. So the singer and the guitar player stayed. I tried to put together a new band around them. It just didn't like really work out. Then I got that job at Licorice Pizza. And I kept seeing these black hair guys and this platinum blonde guy walking up Clark Street. And it turned out to be Motley Crue. In 81, the strip was mostly punk rock. It was before that glam metal change. But I kept seeing these guys in stiletto heels, like walking up Clark Street, which is like straight up. And I'm like, man, these guys are either brilliant or crazy. I'm not really sure which. And turned out they were a little of both. Nicky had invited me up to, he came into the record store with his then girlfriend. He invited me up to their apartment. And that's really kind of where it started for me. I mean, Motley Crue was the first band I saw go from zero to hero, the whole transaction. And once you like have been a part of something like that, it's like chasing the dragon tail, I think. Kind of like drug addicts. It's like, you're always like searching after that high, like the first one, and it's never quite as good. But
tell us how you took that band from zero to hero.
Well, it wasn't just me. I mean, I was a consultant, a management consultant for Motley Crue, and I worked with their first manager, Alan Kaufman, who came from a real estate background. He put in some money into recording, and they put those records out. Too Fast for Love initially came out on Green World Records, was the distribution company, and I helped work that record. I shopped it to a couple major people like John Kalodner.
Hugh has a long history with John as well, so you're more than welcome to swap John's stories.
Yeah, he's awesome.
There's nobody like him.
Yeah, no one's like him. I shopped him Motley Crue, and then I shopped him Poison, you know, and he didn't really like either one of them, mostly vocally. He thought that Vince was too nasally, and I don't know. I just think he was not into glam rock with Poison. And the day that I like was shopping Guns N' Roses, he wasn't there, right? Tom Zutaut had come to the Troubadour and saw him, and he's like, yeah, the one day that she came in with Guns N' Roses, I wasn't there, you know? But
oh, well, not your fault.
I knew Tom was the A&R guy for Guns N' Roses, that's for sure. I had quite an interesting few years with John. We worked on Get a Grip, the first White Snake painting, which I did for that band, as well as Looking Back for Sammy Hagar. And we went down to Florida to meet with when Jimmy wasn't talking to Robert and David had fired his seventh band. We went down to see Coverdale and Page together, which was a nice.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
I saw that tour. It was great.
Yeah. Really good. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. During those years, because, you know, Vicky working with Geffen and then you working so closely with them as well with John. I mean, I'm not kidding when I say you guys probably did cross each other in a lot.
Yeah, we probably did.
You'd have had to. Yeah, you'd have had to.
We were probably standing next to each other at the Form Club having a beer or whatever. But
Probably. And also Capitol. I mean, you mentioned Tommy. You know, I worked with Megadeth at Capitol and a few other projects over there.
Yeah, I worked under Gary Gersh at Capitol. I kind of followed him from Geffen to Capitol.
Obviously, take us back to those. You're talking about the Motley Crue years and kind of seeing them kind of become what they became. But then you went to work with, after Motley Crue, was it then that you went to work with Stryper?
I was a consultant for Stryper and I helped book their shows.
Which was an unusual, that was a Christian band, right?
Yeah. But yeah. I met them when I was a cocktail waitress at Gazzari's. They were not a Christian band then. They were
called
Rock's Regime. Yeah. And I actually even went down to the rehearsal hall in La Mirada and like saw them rehearse. And I saw the Isaiah 53:5 thing, but it didn't like really dawn on me that they had gone Christian. It wasn't until they started throwing Bibles at the crowd that I like, got it.
It was a good marketing thing for those
guys.
Oh,
yeah, totally.
Because I was playing a bunch of, in a lot of the Christian market, I was recording a lot of those records. And I remember when those guys, because there was nothing else like that in Christian music. So the kids ate that up big time.
And Enigma was very aggressive in like getting them in Christian bookstores and things like that. Yeah. I mean, it was really genius how they like pulled that off.
From Stryper then was, who was after that that you kind of saw?
Poison.
Okay.
So Poison, guys, Guns N' Roses and Faster Pussycat all back to back from back there. Back it was back. Busy.
Okay. So the Poison.
I had a few other ones as well, like Darling Cruel, and I'm like managing Greg Darling again now. We just co-wrote a song that came out Friday. So,
yeah. Oh, cool.
You're a writer? A music writer?
I write lyrics. I'm not a music writer. I mean, I took piano lessons for a while and I played flute in high school band, but I'm a hack piano player. Like, you know, I barely get chords out, you know.
I was going to say some albums need a Bernie. So that's, yeah.
Yeah.
I think when most of the people would think of you and your history with that scene at that time, it feels like to me, Motley Crue, of course, but Guns N' Roses, you played such a pivotal role in the beginnings of that band. I mean,
they were my roommates for a while.
Oh, okay. Let's hear about this.
Take us back to those years, because I mean, I want to hear just the stories about, you know, kind of, you know, that band coming together. And I mean, obviously, there's still a huge worldwide.
Well, when I was like booking Stryper, Axel and Izzy, well, Axel called me up and said, you come highly recommended. We'd like help getting some shows. Can we play some music? And I was like, well, send me a tape. He's like, oh, well, can't we just bring you a tape? I was like, well, I don't really have a stereo here. But he's like, oh, it's okay. I'll bring my ghetto blaster. So a couple hours later, they came into my Silver Lining office and like, played me what was the beginnings of Appetite, the demos. And I was like, wow, this is like really good. And I booked them on a show at the Music Machine, which no longer exists, but playing with Stryper and Black Sheep. And at the time, Slash was the guitar player, Black Sheep, you know, there was like this slow-mo moment where I was like, introducing Slash and Axel and they're shaking hands or whatever. I mean, Slash told me later that he like had jammed with Axel before, but I didn't know that. Anyway, that's where they started talking. And, you know, at that point in time, Guns N' Roses was called Hollywood Rose. So Slash and Duff joined and then it was Guns N' Roses. I think Slash and Steven joined at the same time. Yeah, there was a different drummer for Hollywood Rose as well. It was pretty insane, the whole thing. They were living in a rehearsal hall that was not supposed to be a rehearsal hall. There was some legal shit that went down. And Slash called me up and said, can Axel come stay on your couch? And I was like, why? And he's like, well, the cops are looking for him. I was like, yeah, okay. It was only supposed to be a couple days. And then like, the cops kept looking for them. So then the rest of the band, minus Duff, who was living with his girlfriend at the time, like all moved in with me. And I was already sharing the apartment with Jennifer Perry, who booked the Troubadour. Hadn't even gotten a refrigerator yet. It's like all the cold items were like in a little ice chest in the apartment. Oh. The band was like living on the living room floor in like sleeping bags. Axel slept on the couch, but the rest of them were in sleeping bags. And
where was the apartment in town?
Clark Street, like right catty corner from the Whiskey, you know, on the like licorice pizzas on one side of Sunset. And then there was a gas station and then the first apartment building, which kind of faced the back of the Whiskey, and licorice pizza faced the front. I have a lot of history on Clark Street. And it's like Motley Crue also lived on Clark Street. And I lived in that building for a while too. Not when Motley Crue lived there, but couldn't pay me to live down there now.
It's
people just like drop in on you whenever they feel like it.
You're not wanting to move back, you're saying.
Last night being in Hollywood, I was just like, God, I'm so glad I live in Glendale. It's like so quiet. And I'm really only like 15 minutes away. So it's like
with Guns N' Roses. So they obviously, you know, what was kind of the whole process there of you helping them to shepherd them on to where they, you know, got signed. And
so they're in your house.
Yeah.
Yeah. I said to them, they could all come and stay with me if I was the manager. And, you know, I just did this thing on Paramount Plus called I Wanna Rock. And I was telling a story. Mm-hmm. And that's how I cut the deal with Guns N' Roses. I was the manager. And while I was like working out the contract with them, the bidding war broke out. So it was like the lawyer advised me just to keep working it, which ultimately like kind of screwed me in the end. I mean, I did get the A&R job at Geffen, but you know, I didn't have a signed contract, but I got them the deal pretty much because I went and took them to meet with all these record labels and we ate very well for a few weeks. We went to every restaurant in town. Poor Susan Collins like spent like over $1,000 at the Ivy.
So how quickly did that all happen? I mean, they're sleeping on their floor.
It was fast. It was about, I'm going to say a month, maybe two. And then they had decided they were going to sign at Geffen. The next night, we had a show that I was promoting at the Roxy. They announced that they signed with Geffen. And meanwhile, I'd had like 7-8 labels like there to see them. And none of those people were very happy with me. But can't manage the unmanageable, which Guns N' Roses were. It's like they made up their own decisions and off they went.
So after they got signed and went with Geffen, how soon did you start working for Geffen? And soon after that?
It actually took about a year contract to like materialize. And I continued to manage, like I managed Faster Pussycat after that and got them a deal with Peter Philbin at Elektra. I was managing Darling Cruel and Darling Cruel signed with Polygram. After those two records were pretty well cemented, then I started with Salty Dog and Salty Dog signed with Geffen. I was basically a street scout for Geffen. It's like they had like a first right of refusal, but if they passed on it, I could take it to other labels. At one point, I got offered a second right of refusal deal with Sony, but Tom Zutaut wasn't having it. David Geffen said I could do it, but Tom was like, no, she can't do that.
So how many years were you at Geffen then?
From, I think it was like 86 to 92.
Okay. So you were there some big years. And obviously we've talked about the core bands that you're attached to and known to have worked with, but during those years at the labels, you know, who kind of passed through the door during those years that you were either involved in or have any great stories of or anything you can share the label experience during?
There were a lot that got away. I signed Rick Parker, who was in a band called Lions and Ghost, and now he's a pretty well-known producer. I also signed I, Napoleon. I brought in Shadowland and Halfway Home. I tried to sign the Goo Goo Dolls, and David Geffen didn't think they would ever have a hit. They were kind of a punk rock band then. I guess he didn't see Iris coming.
They've had a couple hits.
Yeah. And I tried to sign Concrete Blonde. I'm still a big fan of Johnette Napolitano. We tried to sign Alice in Chains, and I don't know. There were a lot that went through the door.
Well, and also those years were the years where things started to kind of change from what happened in the 80s and very early 90s into obviously the grunge time period. So How much of that did you see coming? Obviously, you mentioned Alice in Chains, but I mean, I remember when Alice in Chains was touring with Van Halen and opening for them and stuff. You know, there was that time in there where there was no grunge. You know what I mean? It was just
late 80s.
Yeah, yeah, late 80s, early 90s even.
I remember a marketing meeting at Geffen where the marketing people were talking about Smells Like Teen Spirit. They were talking about how they were going to promote it. And the marketing team's like, don't do anything. It's working. Just let it work on its own. I mean, that was just kind of like a wildfire. Just
it's good advice. Yeah.
But yeah. It was a different culture too. It's like the metal bands and the glam bands have gotten as glam as they could go. Like every label had like three or four of them.
It was a breath of fresh air.
Yeah. It took it back to like the core beginning. Meanwhile, at the Rainbow, all these like rockers are still thinking they rule the world and they don't see it coming, you know. But soon after, everybody
soon to be out of fashion. Yeah.
Yeah. After that, everyone was like running up to Seattle looking for bands, and a lot of Seattle bands got signed.
So Geffen, and then from Geffen, was it to Capitol then after that?
No, I went to Lookout Management.
Okay.
Yeah, I worked with Elliot Roberts. And,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Elliot and Dave were partners in the 70s and they kind of ran the whole music world. And I feel really lucky to have like worked with them both. They were very different in styles. Both
genes. Elliot ended up going straight just with Neil most of the time, right?
I mean, that was his thing. You know, they never even had a like signed contract from what I understand. It was like all handshake sort of deal, and they were like brothers. I just released Neil's sister Astrid Young's new track that was produced with the Eddie Kramer on my new label Dark Spark Records. That just came out.
I've worked with Eddie.
Eddie's done a lot of insane records.
So how many years were you at Lookout then?
I think one and a half.
Okay.
And then I went to Capitol with Gary Gersh, again, as like a street scout. Geffen was the only time that I put all my eggs in one basket. After that, I was like, okay, I'm going to like still manage bands, but I'll do A&R too.
That had to be fun though, during those years. I mean, as a music fan, right? I mean, just going out and checking out shows and kind of, that had to be great. I mean, that's like a dream job.
I went out every night. I still go out a lot. I was out last night. I'm going out tonight.
It's in your blood.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like 65 now. It's like, I don't want to go out as much. And I have my own little A&R staff that I'll like send out if I don't want to go.
The June Carter Cash thing. Where did that come from? And how did that come to be for you?
I was managing, when I was at Lookout, I was managing a band called the Freewheelers, who were on American Records. And the Freewheelers opened for Johnny Cash at the House of Blues. And I was in the foundation room with, and you know, Rick Rubin and Tom Petty were at the bar, and me and my friend Brian Lowry like went over and started talking to them. And I was just saying how great Johnny was and that I really loved June Carter. Like she kicked him in the butt literally. And like, you know, and Rick Rubin got this like look in his eye, like, you should make a record with June. I was like, ha ha ha, I don't really know anything about country music. And he's like, you were like the coal miner's daughter, because my dad was a coal miner when he was a kid. And I didn't really think anything of it. The next day when I got to my office, there was a note from June Carter that said, Rick Rubin thinks you should make my record. She invited me to tea with her good friend, Rosemary Edelson, the next day. And I went, I just fell in love with her. I mean, she was like a brilliant woman, you know. I really miss her and Johnny, like two of the nicest, most humble people you will ever meet. I tried to talk Elliot into, because Elliot had started a record label called Vapor, and I was like kind of helping them to like get that record label up and running. But he was like, there's no way we're signing a 70-year-old woman to this label and blah, blah, blah. And I decided, okay, well, I'm going to like shop her a deal. I went around and like shopped her to all the major labels, and nobody wanted it. And I was just like, are you freaking kidding me here? It's like, she's from the Carter family. You know, the Carter family was like the first band that ever had a record deal. So how can that be, you know, that nobody wants to do this? I'm not a quitter. I was like, okay, I'm going to start a label. I had no idea what I was doing. I started a label. I joint ventured with a company called Risk Records. I mean, the risk was really on me, not them. But we put out a record and it won a Grammy. You know,
what record was that? Which one was that?
Press On.
I'm good friends with Carlene Carter.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I've met her a couple times. I'm still really close with John Carter Cash, and I go to the Cash Cabin every now and again and record. I mean, it's like a musical vortex, that place for me. It's like I just feel like I'm totally in the spirit when I'm there. There's like a little lake and this right. little cabin. I mean, when we made that record with June, there was like no control room, no ISO booths. It's like J.J. Blair, who engineered the record, like brought most of his equipment from L.A. and they sat in a circle and made that record. Now it's like a legit studio.
It's a real studio. May be recording there next month with Carlene. Yeah. This is the 100th anniversary next year is of the Carter family. So she's going to be touring that.
Absolutely do it. And like, please enjoy.
There's got to be a vibe
John
there.
Carter and the engineer there, a big kiss for me. They're just incredible people. And like John's wife, Anna, is like a really great singer too. She always ends up doing backgrounds on stuff there and stuff, but she should like really, well, she does her own stuff. I'm surprised she's not like huge because she's so good. There's like so many great singers in Nashville. There's no town like Nashville where it's like singers in the round. And I don't know. I think there's a camaraderie there that doesn't exist anywhere else.
I'd have to agree.
Obviously, you know, now you're still working at it. And still, is it just the passion of still, you know, wanting to help out people and, you know, help to try to connect people and get them signed or get their music heard or get their, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. You know, a period where I tried to walk away, and whenever I do, it like somehow figures out a way to come back. Now I have Dark Spark Music through the Orchard and Sony, and I love having a record company and making my own decisions about who I can put out. And some of it's just people I want to help, others I like consult, try and help them go that way. And then I have a couple of bands that I manage that I just think they're it. There's a band from Eau Claire, Wisconsin named Mother Wind, too. Blow my mind. I've only had them for a few months, but I'm gonna make that band happen. Just mark.
What are they like? What are they about?
It's a rock band. The singer is a psych major in school, so most of his songs are like psychological thrillers of some sort. They're all so fun to watch that it's like your eye just kind of jumps all over the stage. It's like the drummer's as exciting to me as the singer as far as performance. Singer has like this voice that's mind-blowing, and he's super cute, so all the girls are gonna like him. And then I have a band called Lovely World out of Spartansburg, South Carolina. Great singer, writer, you know, they're doing pretty good. They just played, oddly enough, that festival in Wisconsin. I just went to see them and Mother Wind in Chicago. I was like pretty happy. My two favorite rock bands played together. So I went. And then I have Outlaws of Moonshine that I consult mm-hmm. that are from Indianapolis. And that's how I met Andy. I mean, mm-hmm. they have like kind of a rare blend of like rock and country that I think is really good. Who else can I tell you about? Oh, I've got a girl from Paris called Sun, and it's Sun Brutal Pop. Her songs all start out sort of poppy, but then she goes into this like deep-throated like growl. I've never heard anybody else do. She's gorgeous and an actress.
How do you meet these people from all the disparate?
Yeah, how do you find them?
A lot of different ways. Some of them just come to me. They search me out. They see me on something and write to me. Sun and Mother Wind came to me through my A&R guy that lives in Paris. He like has a DJ show that he does, and so he's always listening to new bands, and if he thinks I like it, he'll send it to me. I've got a band in London called The Walking Trees that my A&R guy in LA found. Sometimes industry people, lawyers, whatever, will tell me about things. But usually it comes from musicians, I have to say. That's where I find the most of them, because I find that if a musician likes it, they're really good, because they usually hate everything. So whenever,
whenever
a musician tells me that a band is good, I'll listen, because it's so rare. You know, they're usually bagging every band in town. So.
Is there any evidence or online presence for Mother Wing now?
Mother Wind. I think it's Mother Wind Band. Or you can just go into my VickyHamilton.com or Dirk Spark Music, and they're linked to that.
What are the biggest challenges you see for helping bands now compared to what it was, you know, back in the day?
The first main thing is that there aren't the budgets. I mean, when I worked at Geffen, we would just like throw $5,000 down to like do a demo and like give them like 60 days and then decide. I mean, that never happens now. And the playlisting, when I did A&R for major labels, you knew I was the A&R person. You knew to like send it to me. Now the real power seems to lie with playlisters, and they're like a secret society. So unless you know somebody that's like really good at working playlists, it's like you have to kind of figure it out on your own. I've had Dark Spark now for going on 4 years, and I'm just starting to figure out this playlisting thing.
It just seems like now, it's not that it was easy back then by any means, but there was a machine behind it, right? Whereas now it's like you got to try to figure out a way to piece the machine together for everybody.
I think the mistake that most bands make, and the good news is that any band can put out anything through DistroKid or something like that. I mean, it took me like a year to work out my deal with Sony, The Orchard, but you can get your music out there. The thing is, the mistake I see that bands make is they spend all their money on the actual recording of the record, and they've got this great sounding record, but they don't hold anything back to like market their record. And that's right. Like the key component. And it's like, doesn't matter.
Or they just can't afford to.
Yeah.
A lot of these bands can't afford to do that.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if you have a great sounding record if no one hears it.
The labels that used to give you advances are just not there either. Because
And not those budgets anyway.
You've noticed.
Like I co-wrote a song with Greg Darling back in the 80s. That he got signed to on Polygram, and I got a $50,000 publishing deal. Now, if a band that has, I have a million followers gets a publishing deal, they're lucky to get 25 grand. You know what I mean? It's just not, the money's just not where it was.
You've noticed.
Yeah, I've noticed. I also wrote a book called Appetite for Dysfunction, and I call it a cautionary tale because I go into everything that happened to me, or with me, I should say, not to me. I don't want to like sound like a victim. I definitely made all my own choices.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a few of those tales. Well, I will say one thing. I was at the Farm Aid. I played with Steve Earle when it was at Indianapolis in 1990, and Guns N' Roses were the biggest band in the world, right? And
yeah.
Do you remember this moment in time when Steven Adler had just gotten out of rehab? And he runs out, and this is on national TV back then. Farm Aid was on, you know, CBS or something. And he runs out to his drum set and knocks it down. He jumps and he knocks it down.
Oh, no.
And before they even played, it's like, what? And I think he played one gig after that. So anyway, that was one of the wildest things I've ever seen happen. So go ahead.
You know, when I worked with Guns N' Roses, Steven was, well, he wasn't a surfer, but he kind of was like a surfer in like attitude and tone, and he smoked some pot or whatever, but he wasn't into like doing all these heavy drugs. I don't know when that happened. Like when I was managing Guns N' Roses, I was already taking Izzy to rehab, you know. So Steven like started that stuff later, and it's sad because I love Steven. I think he's a brilliant human being. But one of my fun Guns N' Roses stories is, you know, I was taking them to a rehearsal, and I had borrowed a car from Howie Huberman, the station wagon, so we could like take the gear and stuff. And my car wasn't working very well. And he had Ernie and Bert doll in the back seat because his kid, you know, and I was like, okay, don't mess with any of Howie's kids' toys or whatever. And I'm driving down the road and Axel's like sitting in the front seat with me and everybody with Duff was in the car. I smell something burning. I'm like, what is that? And I look and they're all like smirking, right? I'm like, what's going on? What's burning back there, right? And I see Ernie and Bert tied to guitar strings, hanging out the window, like smoking a cigarette. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to like kill you guys.
Nice.
I asked you not to do that.
Boys will be boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kids will be kids. This is my story. Looking back on it, it was really fun. But that day I was like really pissed off at them almost all day long. But
with all those acts, do you still stay in touch with any of them to this day?
Oh, yeah. I still talk to Slash. Slash is like my boy. I even auditioned him for Poison. He got the gig for a minute, but he said, I'm not going to wear all the fucking makeup. And I'm not going to say, they did this whole thing where it's, hi, I'm Brett. Hi, I'm Bobby. And we're Poison. He goes, and I'm not going to say, hi, my name's Slash. And it was like, they hired him. And then the next day he was out.
Oh, yeah. So 24 hours. Yeah. I had a good Slash story. Actually, he played a show in Indianapolis years ago. He was out with the Snake Pit thing. He kept falling asleep in the car all day. And I kind of thinking, gosh, is he okay? You know what I mean? And literally like 2 days later, there was like national news where he was having real heart problems, and he was having heart problems in Pittsburgh or something, because I think that was the next city. But I was really concerned about him all day. I was like, you know, they were like, you know, what is he on something? What is going on? And they kept saying, no, he's not. I don't know why he keeps nodding off and falling asleep. Well, it's basically because
he did a lot of abuse.
But that was like a few days before he had this whole heart thing come down in Pittsburgh. I was
like, gosh, he had like a thing, not a pacemaker, but something like a pacemaker put in for a while. But I don't think, you know, he's sober now. So
yeah, seems like he's doing well now. Keep some pictures of him jumping off the stage and all that kind of stuff. So seems to be doing fine.
Yeah. I mean, he would be on the road 365 days a year if they'd let him, you know?
Yeah.
No, he likes to rock still.
Busier than ever. Yeah. Well, this has been fun. I mean, just kind of going down memory lane with you and your career. And it's awesome to see that you're still helping acts out. You know, that's the thing. We talk about those bands now because we all know who they are, but all of those bands were in the same bucket as, you know, some of the others that you're working with and starting out and helping now, you know, at one point in their career. So it's awesome.
Yeah, it was more special doing like June Carter for me, because all the bands that I've worked with were baby bands. When I think about Slash or whatever, he's still like my kid.
Right. Yeah.
He's like this huge rock star, but he's still my kid.
You also had to babysit some of those people in the little.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah. I was doing Poison. I used to put in the ads, manager and babysitter, you know.
I bet. Great.
Well, yeah. Hey, just telling the truth.
I think there's a little bit of that all through the industry, whether you're A&R or you're a manager, or even good producers have to know how to psychologically get through that babysitting, you know, gathering the kittens into a bag.
I want to make a t-shirt that says can't manage the unmanageable. That's like,
great. Like you said that earlier.
Yeah, I like that.
It is good.
But I love musicians. It's like, where would we be without music, right?
Exactly. That's why we're on here today.
That should be your credo, not can't manage. You should just say managing the unmanageable. That's what you do. You know?
Well, sometimes. Mm-hmm. Most of the times it's like herding feral cats, but
somebody's got to do it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it's all about, you know, if you wouldn't have been there for those bands, you were the person, the right person at the right place at the right time to help them in those years, you know, before they really blew up. But you also helped them get to the point so when they did, and that's really cool. I mean,
I think I made a deal with God before I came down and said, okay, yeah, we'll give you this great job, but you're going to have to eat some shit in the meantime.
Yeah, well, welcome
it's
to the
It's a shit
music
sandwich,
business.
But put a little mayonnaise on it for me, could you?
Sweeten it up a little bit.
Come on now.
Well, congrats, Vicky, all your success over the years and the book. And I see you on TV every once in a while. And you mentioned the Paramount Plus thing that just came out
recently.
Yeah,
it's called I Want to Rock. Watch it. It's like, it's
awesome.
Good.
Yeah. It looks awesome. So. Continued success to you and your bands and everybody that you're working with.
I'm trying to sell my book as a fictionalized TV series. So Hopefully that'll happen.
Great. Yeah, that'd be great. Awesome.
That would be the payoff for all the babysitting.
Absolutely. There you go. You deserve it.
Yeah, you do.
The only other film from that era that struck a chord with me was Rockstar. That was a good movie, actually.
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
Quite insightful.
And it was based on a true story, right? Because
Judas Priest,
that
right?
Singer was, didn't they base that on Judas Priest?
Judas Priest, yeah. Judas what was the guy's name? I forget the guy's name, but yeah.
Yeah.
You're right.
I remember,
liked Daisy Jones and the Six, too, which was based loosely on Fleetwood Mac, but you should see that. It's good. Daisy Jones and the Six. It's on Amazon.
I remember watching Rockstar and suddenly the cameo that I could relate to, and I heard his voice before I saw the camera pan around, but I'm sure you worked with Niels Losauer in your years.
I certainly know him. I didn't do any of those sessions, but
I thought he did a lot of Motley work. Yeah.
Yeah. I worked Motley when they were dealing with like Don Atkins and stuff. It was the leather record, you know, once they went on to Elektra, I was out of a job. They went to Doc McGee and Doug Thaler.
I know those guys too. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Doug Thaler mentored me. He's an amazing man. As is Bob McCutcheon, who is one of my.
Oh, mentors. Bob. He's my buddy.
Yeah. That's how I met Andy too. Mm-hmm. I've known Bob since I was like 15. I used to beg him for stage passes when he worked at Sunshine. Whenever I have anything going on in Indiana, though, I call Bob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. Now he's still
a
here.
Good guy. He used to manage me in my band about 20 years ago for a little while.
Yep.
I remember that because he put me on the list for Universal for John Cougar.
Well, this was my personal band, Dane Clark.
But you play Cougar, right?
I play for him, yeah. I'm still in his band. This is my 27th year.
Wow.
And we just played 77 shows between February and the end of June. So that's a lot for old guys.
Yeah, thank you for the time. Good to talk to you. We appreciate it.
Have a good day.